My name's Duncan. I'm a member of ACA.
Hi, Duncan.
Hi, everybody. Thank you to the trusted servants of this meeting that have been keeping this going more than a year now. And lots of speaker recordings on our website that people can listen to. Thanks to all the trusted servants that are keeping our meetings going here in town and other places. I want to thank my hairdresser, Catherine, in the back, and my sponsors back there. My chauffeur to the punk rock burlesque show later tonight, and my personal chef are all here tonight, so really appreciate it. My ACA story starts a few generations before I was born. The Red Book describes it's kind of a tear-jerking description of a bundle that's mostly shame that's passed from parent to child, from generation to generation. And when I read that in the book, I could feel it in my stomach. It was passed to my mother, and she passed it to me without knowing. It was passed to my father. And my father has struggled with it his whole life and helps pass it to my brother and sister and I. Three of my grandparents were alcoholic. I don't know how many of the previous generation. My mom, her brother and sister, all alcoholic. Some addiction, it is addiction, but other forms of addiction across between the two families. Luckily for me, kind of a rare case here, both my parents were in recovery before I was, and so once I got going in this recovery, I was able to go to my parents and ask them for details about their life when they were children, and my life when I was very young, and they were very open with me and shared with me about neglect and abuse that had happened to them and that they had inflicted on me when I was an infant, and we cried together about those things, and so appreciative to my father and to my mother for getting into recovery. They got into recovery because my mother's alcoholism. Dad went to Al-Anon first, more than 40 years ago. And after he started going to Al-Anon, things became much more peaceful at home. I was, I think, 11 or 12 when Dad started going to Al-Anon. Prior to that, my mom's alcoholism would go up and down. Sometimes it wasn't so bad and things were a little easier at home and there was a lot of love and we did a lot of fun things, family camping trips and so forth. But other times it would turn and be chaotic, a lot of arguing and fighting between my parents, neglect and abuse happening kind of sporadically, unpredictably. It wasn't like a constant, steady thing at our house. Part of my story is that our family moved every couple of years, and I really struggled more with school than I did with my family. I kept showing up as the new kid. And those of you that know me, I'm kind of strange, odd character, and I'm like a bully magnet when I was a kid. And they would test me, and I just hated it. I remember I ran a little bit of track when I was in junior high, and I used to be running from people. They would be chasing me, and I would be running for my life, and it was really hard. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't like school. I didn't want to go home. I didn't like home. I was torn between being home to help protect my younger brother and sister and wanting to be gone. I spent a lot of time at the top of my favorite tree. Whenever we moved to a new place, I find my tree, and I would climb to the top of the tree and spend a lot of time there. It's the only place I felt safe. It was the only place that was peaceful, and I would kind of like try to blend with the sky or something. I used to talk to the sky and ask the spaceships when they were going to come back and fetch me, as if somebody had left me with strangers or something. I felt like I didn't fit in. I felt like I didn't fit in with my family. I felt like I didn't fit in at school. At school, I would try to make friends in all the different groups so I could feel safe. And I would manage to make a few friends, I was kind of being a chameleon. I don't know if I was really being my real self, you know. Then we would move, and it would just feel like abandonment to me, you know, over and over and over again. It was really hard. There were times when I prayed for God to kill my parents because they were being so mean to each other. They were much more at each other than they were at us kids. It was a time when, you know, getting harsh disciplinary whippings was in, you know, and I got my share of that. That didn't hurt as much, though. What really hurt was the way that people were treating each other, the way people were talking to each other. I couldn't stand how it felt. I disconnected from my heart and from my stomach. It hurt so bad, and I kind of went hiding in my head, in my thoughts, and I made up stories. I made up something else than what was going on. I tried to have a good time. We have a lot of family pictures of us playing and having fun. You know, we had those big wheels, and my dad took us fishing, and we'd go to the big hill and ride these big wheels down the hill and almost kill ourselves, you know, crashing these things and jumping our Schwinn cheater slick bikes on ramps that we would build when Evel Knievel was real big. We were trying to replicate that, and we had a lot of fun. But there was this unspoken, hidden, underlying stuff going on. I could never bring anybody home after school to my house because my mother was too unpredictable. It was too unpredictable about the chemistry that would happen between my parents. They really weren't really compatible. I remember, it seems like I knew from the get-go as the oldest child that I caused my parents to be stuck together. And I really appreciate them for taking care of me and my brother and sister and doing the right thing and all. But it was really tragic that they got stuck with each other, and I could tell that my dad didn't want to be there. He used to volunteer to go off to war to get away from the family. My mother, usually when she was drunk, would kind of brainwash us about my father not being fun. She would call him names and so forth and make fun of him and belittle him. And I got confused about who my father was and whether I really liked him or not. And my father didn't do that so much about my mom, but I could tell that my mom was really screwed up. But she seemed like the nice one sometimes, so I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't tell who was who. I was so confused because there wasn't enough honesty, you know, openness, and real sharing in the family system or even at school. Everybody was just trying to be so cool and so competitive and trying to win, and I hated these systems of being. I wanted us to all collaborate and help each other and be nice, and I had all these ideals about how I wish we would, you know, be together. I still have that now. That's part of what I love about recovery, because we're actually mostly nice to each other. At least in front of each other. And, you know, it's nice that, you know, when somebody listens to me complaining about whatever, you know, when I have the illusion of thinking that somebody else is acting, you know, wrong, people just listen to me, and then they don't go, you know, take it seriously. And usually after I have a chance to complain, I chill out and get humble again. Right? So I want to thank you all for keeping my confidence, because I don't have it together all the time. You know, I try to practice ABC, always be cool, but it just doesn't work, you know? I can't do it. So Dad went to Al-Anon. I was 11 or 12. Mom kept drinking for a couple more years, and she was causing a lot more problems now because Dad wasn't throwing pillows under her and, you know, protecting her from natural consequences. She went through 3 treatment centers and got sober in AA. And my parents kind of split up at that point, and Dad didn't come back anymore. We kept in touch, but he wasn't around much. And my brother and I started drinking that year. I was 14, my brother was 11. The same year my mom got sober, my brother and I just dove headfirst right into alcoholism and addiction. What a nightmare for my mother. But I was in a lot of pain. I needed, you know, by the time I was 14, I had 14 years of fear, frustration, confusion, anger, grief, all packed down nice and tight. And when I drank and did drugs, I started drinking and drugging in New Jersey. And I thought Alana looked familiar. I remember seeing chicks that looked like they were tripping on LSD, driving little bands of gypsies around in Jersey. What exit were you? No, never mind. So I started that in New Jersey, and my brother got involved when he was only 11 years old, and my girlfriend got involved, and just, that was so fun, because it just turned everything off, you know? It's just like, I was medicating myself, I was running away, it really, you know, bolted the lid on everything that I was holding inside. And I wasn't just holding my own stuff inside, I was holding my parents' stuff inside, I was holding my grandparents' stuff inside. That bundle I had inside, it was generations of energy packed in that bundle, it's been passed forward and forward. So, I got in trouble right at the end of college. The police came to my house. I was studying marketing and distribution systems in college. And I was running an interstate distribution network that ran from Florida to Colorado to New Jersey to Virginia. I was in college in Virginia. So Virginia was kind of like my sales hub, and then my sourcing was coming from all over the place. And as I went through college, I kept inheriting more and more of the market because, you know, when the seniors graduate, they pass the clientele on to the juniors and, you know, and so on and so forth. So I had a fun time when I was a senior. I was, you know, really popular within the subgroup and really felt powerful. And I was having a really, it was the most powerful I ever felt in my life. But it wasn't real power. It was imitation power. It was false self, like having a big parade. But if you could see what was really going on, not a happy camper. And near the end of college, I remember having bouts of depression and anxiety attacks when other people weren't around, especially if I wasn't drinking enough or using enough. And I remember saying a prayer, God, if you're real, if you can hear me, you know, I feel bad inside. I don't know, something's wrong with me. I felt like something was wrong with me. I felt like something was wrong with me my whole life. If you're there, could you like reel me in, you know, pull me in the boat or something? I just feel like I'm stuck at the bottom of a muddy pond. And a few days later, the police came to my house. And they arrested me and charged me with 2 misdemeanors and 5 felonies. And all of a sudden I was facing up to 40 years in the Virginia State Penitentiary and $500,000 fine. And I went and talked to a lawyer, and the lawyer said, you're loaded right now, and it's only 10 o'clock in the morning, and you're in here to talk to me about this stuff. Are you an addict? I mean, you can't control it, can you? It's out of control, you know. If you're going to, is this your first offense? Yeah. If you could possibly get out of this, but you can't keep using and partying, we can tell when you're loaded. And I tried to deny and say that I wasn't loaded. Anyway, I decided that I would stay clean just till I got out of trouble, and it began my campaign to get out of trouble. And my parents came to see me graduate from college, and I started crying and told them the truth about what was happening, and my mom said, oh my God, honey, I need to go to a meeting. do you want to go with me? And she had invited me and tried to get me to come to meetings for a few years. Now, my brother was already in recovery at that point. She said it would look good in court if you went to a meeting. I said, okay, let's go. So we went to an AA meeting, and there were about 200 people there, and I was like by the door, and as soon as the meeting ended, I jetted out the door. Over my shoulder, I saw my mom hugging strangers. She was visiting from out of town. What the heck is going on here, you know? We don't know these people. Later that night, she said, there's another program called Narcotics Anonymous. Maybe you'd feel more comfortable there. I said, well, it has a nice name. Does it look good in court? Yes, it looks good in court. Let's go. We go to the NA meeting. There are 6 people, including my mother and I. Nowhere to hide. We're sitting in this little circle. I wasn't making any eye contact. I was sitting there. They all shared. The leader of the meeting said, how about you? Do you want to say anything? I said, yeah, if anybody here ever got in trouble with the law and got out of it, talk to me after the meeting. That's it. And the guy that was leading the meeting said, you're in the right place. Well, everybody at the meeting who's been in trouble and recovery has helped you get out of trouble, raise your hand. And everybody at the meeting, including my mom, raised their hand. And I knew it was true about my mom. She hadn't been in any trouble since she had been coming to recovery. She had gotten so much better. I mean, at that point, she was 10 years sober and just radiant and so loving and so grateful she was there for me when I was ready to come into recovery. So they kept holding these legal charges over my head for more than a year. Then they decided to put me on 4 years of probation. And I stayed clean, and I started my own business, and this and that, and I did 5 years of NA and AA. And after 5 years being clean, some of the folks in the meeting said, you know what, Duncan, you've got a really great program. Good job. You have really taken this on, using all the tools, really, really doing it. I'm so grateful. I want to thank the people that were there for me in my first few years of recovery. I got an excellent recovery education from these people, you know. And I had worked through the steps. I had studied the steps. I had interviewed hundreds of members about how they do the steps. And I had been practicing applying the steps. And it really was working for me. The problem is, I became an arrogant, self-righteous know-it-all that thought he knew how you should be working your program. Mm-hmm. And they said, nah, nah, go to Al-Anon. So I went to Al-Anon, where I started to learn to mind my own business, work my own program, that there's actually boundaries and responsibilities. And there's, you know, and I got better there. And I worked with an Al-Anon sponsor for a year. And at the end of the year, the Al-Anon sponsor said, nice work. I bet you're getting along a lot better with the AA and NA members now, aren't you? I said, yes. He said, now it's time for ACA. And I said, what? How many programs do I have to go to? He said, here, read these 14 traits of people who grew up in dysfunctional families. And I read them. And I answered yes to all 14 of them. And it awakened in me a curiosity that was just burning as hot as any curiosity I had had about recovery. And I started going to the ACA meetings with my sponsor. Now he's my Al-Anon and ACA sponsor. And this is in Virginia. I got sober in Virginia. And we started going to the meetings, and now it's like this. Okay, AA and NA was like houses on fire. AA members are like the fire department. They come, I cooperate, we put the fire out. Now my house is kind of charred and smoking, but it's not on fire anymore. And that's great. Al-Anon was like redecorating the house. New ways of interaction between the people in my life. It's about communication styles and this kind of thing, right? ACA is like opening the basement door and going down into the musty basement and prying open the caskets of my ancestors to pull out the skeletons of my family closet. It was, oh my God, the feelings that started coming out. I didn't know they were in there. I was 6 years clean and sober and having a good time, and now ACA brought me to these reservoirs of energy that were still suppressed inside. The grief, the fear, the anger from my childhood now was becoming available to me by participating in ACA. And I dove back into the step work again. The inventory work was a lot of new material. I was writing inventory material about what happened when I was little, about the patterns that I saw, and feelings were coming. And thank God, somebody turned me on to this idea. Duncan, you are overwhelmed with your feelings right now. What percent of these feelings are current about your here and now situation that's just triggered you? And what percentage of these feelings are from the past that are taking this opportunity to come to the surface and be expressed so that you can be free from them? And I said, about 80-20. I'm 20% mad about what so-and-so just said and did. And I'm 80% mad, isn't even about right now. It's because this reminds me of when that kid at school or that principal was beating me or whatever it was. And I got encouraged. When you have these opportunities for this old feelings to come to the surface, don't hide, don't run, don't distract yourself. Take your time to sit with these feelings, let yourself feel these feelings. Get in touch with another ACA member and express the feeling. Share about the meaning. Scream, cry. So I had this thing for the anger, because I had a ton of anger. I had a baseball bat by the door of my apartment, and when I would know that it was coming and it was time to let a bunch of it out from the past, I'd walk down to the park with my baseball bat. And you didn't want to mess with me at that, when I was on that mission. And I would go to the back part of the park where the city landscape crews would dump all the tree branch cuttings, and there was a lot of dead branches back there, because that pile just sat there for years. And I would go to town on these dead branches with this baseball bat, and I would say, "This one's for you, Miss Smith." And I would start hitting the thing, and I would start cussing out my fifth grade teacher who sent me to the principal's office every day, and I would start cussing out the principal who would hit me with the board most days of the week, who I threw a snake on one time during a fire drill out in the parking lot. And I purged off these feelings. You know, there's one down here on the 101 on the way to Ventura. You know that big stack that has a big flame on it all the time? Up beside the 101? It's burning off all the extra stuff that comes up, right? Yeah, make one of those for yourself. Put it somewhere where it won't catch everything on fire that you hold dear. And when it's time, just let it rip. And the old stuff burns off eventually. It's a million gallons. But after months and some years, the reservoirs are kind of empty now. Now I get upset about present time stuff, but there's not this big flood of past stuff. There's only a certain amount in there. And when you get free of it, you're done with the past. It's really cool. I love that about ACA. I kept working the ACA program. There was no Red Book at that time. There was no, this is like early 90s. And in 97, I moved to California, and I was living up near Yosemite, and there was no ACA that I knew of. And I kept going to recovery, but I wasn't doing any ACA for a few years. And then it was about maybe 15 years ago, I ended up in Thousand Oaks. And in Thousand Oaks, there's excellent ACA that's been going on for a long time. And there's a bunch of ACA old-timers there that are really valuable. If you were here the last time I spoke, right, when I got back from Russia last August, my co-speaker was Eileen from Thousand Oaks. And remember us singing "You Are My Sunshine" at the end of the meeting? Wasn't that lovely? Eileen's 80, almost 90 years old now. And just a few years ago, we had her first birthday party that she ever had in her life. Because she shared at the ACA meeting that she had never had a birthday party, and she was like 86. So her birthday was coming up when she shared that, and we had ACA members take her for lunch, and we had something with a candle on it, and she started making her own birthday parties for her family and friends every year since then. This beautiful ACA. She had been in ACA for a long time, but now she does birthday celebrations for herself. It's beautiful. So I started back into ACA in Thousand Oaks, and man, now we had the Red Book. So I start reading the Red Book, and it was kind of like starting ACA again, because there's really a lot of information in the Red Book. And so I started learning more about my ACA recovery again, really diving into ACA. I came to Santa Barbara about 10 years ago or so, and there was no ACA here. It had dwindled off, as Alana had said. And I was still going back to Thousand Oaks for ACA meetings, and there's good ACA meetings in Ojai also. And I kept thinking, I wish there was ACA in Santa Barbara. I wish there was ACA in Santa Barbara. And whenever I would think, I wish there was ACA in Santa Barbara, something in me would also think, it's up to you, Duncan. If you want ACA, you can start a meeting. And it was like it was my higher power, just was right there, you know. And I don't want to have to do that. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. And then I kept talking about it, though. I talked about it. Here's a recipe for getting a meeting started in a new place. I was going to a lot of Al-Anon meetings here in Santa Barbara, and after the meetings, I would go to the people who shared obvious ACA issues, and I would say, hey, thanks for sharing about, you know, the challenges that you grew up with. Wow. I can relate with that. I also had a bunch of that stuff. Have you heard of ACA? No, what's that? Oh, let me tell you about it. Oh my God, that sounds so good. Where's the meeting? Well, we don't have one yet. Well, if you start one, let me know, because I want to come. And when I had 12 people that were bugging me, when are we going to start that ACA thing? Then Renee got us the little library at the senior center down on Della Vina, and we had 11 people at the first meeting, almost 20 people at the second meeting, and more people at the third meeting, and we immediately had to move out to Montecito, where the meeting is now, the Wednesday night meeting. And it just started growing. We had 30 people in the meeting. All of a sudden, we started the Sunday meeting just a few weeks after the Wednesday meeting started, and wow, now we have 5 meetings a week here in Santa Barbara, plus the monthly speaker meeting here. We've got an intergroup going that's done a bunch of projects. We've done a bunch of workshops and had a retreat, and I think there's a picnic in the planning, and we're in the hospital now, and we're starting to do more outreach, and we're connected with, we're starting to get connected with the region, Western States region of ACA. I've gone over to Russia a couple of times and done a bunch of ACA service over there. The chair of the Moscow ACA intergroup is my best friend in Russia. It's amazing. And we put on big workshops when I've been over there. 200 people, 150, 200 people have come to those. How do I want to tie a bow on this? Something I like to do is look at the laundry list when I'm agitated, you know, because I know when I'm agitated, my character defects are in play, you know, or I'm processing old energy, and I like to try to sort out what's going on with me. I like to look at the laundry list and go, which laundry list items are lighting up for me, right? It's just like the instrument panel on my truck. If I just look at it, you know. There it is. The fear of authority figures is blinking at me. You know, that's what's going on in my situation right now. Or I'm afraid of people, or whatever it is. I like to look over at the promises, because the promises describe what I'm trying to switch to. I don't want to be afraid of people. So which promise is that? We became more comfortable, or I'm worried about money and whether I'm going to be okay. We will become financially secure and learn how to play and have fun in our life, or whatever it is. So it kind of gives me a cue to what to try to practice. I really like the other laundry list. Or there's the other side of the laundry list, and then there's the other laundry list, and then there's the other side of the other laundry list. And there's the new laundry list workbook that's out that describes all of this. It's awesome. It's awesome. I really like that part. It's given me a lot of tools. I'm out of isolation, and yet I still kind of struggle with that some. Like, do I spend too much time in solitude, or am I mixing it up enough with other people? I'm on the phone with other fellow travelers every day. I'm on the telephone with local members here. I'm on the phone with members in other places. I'm on Skype and FaceTime with members in Russia and other places. And so I'm doing a lot of communication about recovery. And sometimes it still feels like I'm sitting at home or sitting, not getting out to events and not connecting with people enough. So I'm still working on that. I feel good about myself. I feel like I'm doing good stuff. I really love being of service. I want to put a pitch for service. I got taught early in my recovery to get involved with service because it would help connect me with the recovery process and fellowship in a way that not being involved with service would not allow for. If I just attend and I participate, that's a quality of connection with the process. And if I take a service commitment and I start to try to be of service somehow, it's a different quality of connection with the process. It's a different quality of connection with the other people that are there and so forth. So I started out with being a setup person at a meeting, and then I became a secretary of a meeting, and I've been a treasurer of a meeting, and I've been an intergroup rep for meetings, and I've done some area service stuff, and starting to do some regional service stuff. And but for me, just like staying after the meeting and talking with people and being the last one to leave is a great service. Our intergroup is trying to get a few different projects going, and we're just waiting for people to get inspired to want to try out doing some service. One that I'm hoping that we'll see happen soon is a purchasing agent to buy discounted bulk literature from the World Service Office. They'll give us a 30% discount if we can have one person who is registered with them and does the purchasing, so that it stays simple for them and stays clear and that same person's doing it. We just need somebody that'd be willing to make the order of four or five cases of literature at a time and keep that at their place and distribute it to the meetings. We'd save a lot of money on the freight and shipping that all the individual groups pay to get small orders here, and the 30% discount could be, most of that would be passed on to members purchasing literature, and a small portion of it would help fund intergroup activities. So that's kind of the way WSO has it all laid out. So I'm hoping we'll get that going. It's really exciting. I really love having new people come, all the time, because I'm here a lot. I see new people come. They're shaky. They're unsure. They have that old feeling I had of self-doubt and fear and not knowing if things are going to be okay and wondering if there's really something wrong with them that'll never get better. And the ones who keep coming back get so much better pretty fast. Things get a lot better pretty fast, and then things get tough and get a little. But it gets easier, and then it goes around and around, and we kind of take turns falling apart and carrying each other across the finish line. Amen. Stay connected. When we risk moving out of isolation, the healing begins. So help us all out, especially yourself, by calling a fellow traveler in between meetings and just checking in. Thank you.